Let's start with today's lecture. We stopped in the last lecture somewhere in the last slides regarding a priori. However, I've read in the forum that there have been some questions regarding every slide, starting with slide 16. So I will go back to that. I will not go into detail on every slide back here, but I will try to round it up again. Last time we discussed how a priori works in general. A priori has some disadvantages because we have to recount something, we have to count every time we have candidates. And there can be a huge amount of candidates. We can solve that problem to be able to count less candidates or to have less counting steps by building a hash tree. That's a pretty simple solution where we put different candidate item sets. So one, item one, item four, and item five build a candidate three item set, length three item set, which might become a frequent item set if it satisfies the threshold, the minimum support threshold. We don't know with minimum support threshold in here, but we know there is some minimum support threshold. And now we go through that whole tree with a specific subset function to find where in our tree this specific candidate item set will be. And we only have to count this trace. The next slide, and that slide was specifically mentioned in the forum, is the SQL statement regarding item candidate generation for SQL, with SQL. I mentioned during the last lecture, this slide is not relevant for the exam. This slide will not be part of the exam. This is just to show you we are able to do SQL statements. We are able to implement a priori with SQL. However, I wouldn't expect you to understand all details within that SQL statement, and we just do not have time to go into detail in this SQL statement, so I will skip it here again. But it's not relevant for the exam to understand this statement or to be able to write it yourself. It's just for you to look it up if you ever want to implement a priori within SQL. Then we have some further improvements. I think I've talked about this hash table in some detail last lecture as well. However, there have been some misconceptions I've seen later in the questions after the lecture, where people didn't understand how this hash table works. Basically, let's say we have original data set, transactional data set, a transactional database with 1, 2, 3 transactions. Okay? Simple as that. And we have the items A, B, C in the first transaction, the items A and B in the second transaction, and C and B in the third transaction. We determined min support is 2, so every one item set will become frequent, of course, because A is present in 2 transactions, B is present in 2 transactions, and C is in 3 transactions, and C is also present in 2 transactions. And now we have the candidate item sets A, B, A, C, and BC. What we can do, of course, is to count each of them for their own. A small example like that is, of course, possible to count that. However, with hashing, we do something like putting many candidate item sets into one bucket. Let's say we put them all into one bucket. Of course, that wouldn't make any sense in the real world. But let's say there's a D as well. Let's do it this way. Maybe it's easier to have a... example like that. These are in this bucket, and this is in this bucket. Now we do not count each candidate for themselves, but we count whether any of these transactions is present within a transaction. So within transaction one, is there AB, AC, or BC present? Yes, at least one, all of them are present within that. So we simply increase the count by one. Now we check for the same transaction one, whether there's at least one transaction, one item set of this combination, of these combinations present. No, it isn't. So we do not increase the count of that bucket. The same thing for the second transaction. Is one candidate of the first bucket present? Yes. Is one candidate of the second bucket present? Yes, BD. And the same thing for the last transaction, yes and yes. Now these are our total counts for the buckets, for the hash buckets. And therefore we can't exclude any of the candidates. In an ideal world, maybe we should remove that and therefore have a bucket like this, because now the second transaction doesn't contain the second bucket. We know, due to this bucket only having a count of one, that neither this candidate nor this candidate can be frequent, because we counted only to one. And if the count is increased, if at least one is present, then we know that neither BD nor CD can have a support count higher than one. For these candidates, we still have to start counting them for each for their own. However, this first step of counting only buckets or hashes decreases the counts we have to do by a lot, and therefore decreases the effort we have to take to count our candidates. Of course, with larger data sets than this example, but I can show you an example with 1,000 different things. That's not possible in here. The second thing is that we can, of course, partition our data set also into different subsets of transactions. So let's say we have a transactional database, and we have a fourth transaction, maybe this one. And we split the database into two partitions. Partition one, partition two. Okay? And now we can, at least if we have a relative support limit, count for the first and the second partition whether our items are frequent in there. Let's say in the first partition, and our min support is not in total, but relative in this case. And we say 50% of transactions should contain an item to, for the item to become frequent. Let's count in the first partition, A is 1, is 2, B is 2, C is 1, D is 0. And in the second partition, we have A being 1, B being 2, C being 2, and D being 1. Now we can, in the first transaction, say A is frequent within that section because it satisfies min support of 50%. Let's do 75% for the example to be become better. So our min support is 75%. A satisfies that. B satisfies that. C doesn't satisfy that. D doesn't satisfy that. In the second partition, A doesn't satisfy our 75% threshold. B does satisfy it. X and D don't satisfy that. Now, due to the fact that D doesn't satisfy our relative support in not at least one of it partitions, we can conclude that D can be frequent in the complete database as well. Because if it doesn't satisfy the threshold in at least one, oh, this one's wrong, of course, one of the partitions, how can it be frequent in the complete data set? That's not possible. For all the other data sets, we have to recheck it because we can't say anything about that, about those for the complete data set. They satisfy the threshold in at least one of the data sets, and therefore we have to recheck it. For B, you can argue, since it satisfies the threshold in all partitions, it's fulfilling the threshold. But for the others, we have to recheck. And that's basically how partitioning works. We try to lower the amount of candidates we have to recheck in the complete data set. Because going through a whole big database is more expensive than to go through a small partition step by step by step. We can run it in different threads and things like that. Also, we can, of course, sample our original database. So take some transactions out of our original database and simply check for the thresholds in there. This is, of course, not a 100% correct solution after all. We can have luck in one sample to include a not really representative amount of transactions, and then our frequent pattern analysis wouldn't work 100% correct. I guess that's pretty obvious. One thing that is pretty important, because that's something that is easy to implement and decreases the amount of scans, but it increases the performance of a priori, is the dynamic item set counting. Let's say we start with, of course, zero item sets. And we now check for our one item sets, A, B, C, and D, like we do in a priori. We start with checking for one item sets. And we go through the whole database to count A, B, C, D. Then once we know that A and B are frequent, so we, again, I try it. Try to do it on this example. So we have A, B, C, D, and in this case, we have a min support of 2. Okay, we are in the first transaction. Count the first transaction. A is 1, B is 1, and C is 1. Now we are in the second transaction. A is 2, B is 2. Now we know that A and B have to be frequent because they just reached the threshold. Whatever happens in the next transactions, we know that these two have to be frequent. And the idea of dynamic item set counting is to now not wait for all the transactions to be counted, but for the item sets we just got to know that are frequent, we start by combining them. So we combine A and B, which gets us to A and B. And while continuing with transaction 3, we also count A and B. So within transaction 3, of course, C increases the count by 1, D increases the count by 1, and B increases the count by 1. This is not increased and this is not increased. But for 4, we increase, and now, of course, we have to combine these two to create this candidate, and of course, A and C as well. So we have 3 candidates right now. And in transaction 4, we count A, we increase count of A by 1, we increase the count of B by 1, we increase the count of C by 1, but we also increase the count of CB by 1, and we increase the count of AC by 1, and we increase the count of AB by 1. And now, for these two, we have to continue to count from the top down till here, because that's where we started to do that. And for this one, A and B, we of course only have to count till here. So now we can get back to 1, count AC increased by 1, AB increased by 1, and CB increased by 1, and we start by combining those together till we get 3 candidates. And we therefore do not have to continue through the whole database k times to get to k item sets, but we might only have to do k minus 1 or k minus 2 times because we start counting earlier in the data set. This is, of course, only a small improvement, but for a bigger data set, it's a worthwhile improvement to do that. Is that explanation understandable, how dynamic item set counting works? Okay. When we get to, I guess, the biggest improvement of a priori, or frequent pattern analysis method, we will get to in this lecture, because we will now talk about a totally new method. While a priori is a pretty simple method, you just count through the whole database, generate candidates, count through the database again, and so on. FP growth is an approach that has seen the disadvantages of a priori, having multiple runs through the whole database, having a huge amount of candidates to count, and try to improve that. this approach, FP Grove, was created by Han et al. Han is also the author of the book we are basing this lecture on, so I guess that's pretty obvious to include that approach. But it's also the second most often used frequent pattern growth algorithm in the real world. A priori is more often used, even if it's less performant, because it's easier to implement. FP Grove is more performant, but harder to understand, I have to add. The basic idea of FP Grove is based on trees. We will see that in a slide or two. And the major idea is to take short frequent patterns, short item sets, and combine them to longer item sets. So let's start with how FP Grove is working. Let's say we have a data set like here. Again, we have a transactional data set, and only take a look at the TID column and the item sport column for now. Okay? We have 5 transactions in this case containing some single letter items. So each letter is one item. The first transaction contains F, A, C, D, G, I, M, and P as board items. To run FP Grove, we have to scan the database once to find the frequent item, one item sets. This is exactly the same as we would have done with a priori. We just take a look at each item being part of any transaction. I will not do that by hand in here, but let's try to do that. We have A, B, C, D, and count them, whether they satisfy the min support. If they satisfy min support and become frequent, we put them into a frequency descending list. This list is called the F list. So let's say in this example, we have multiple different frequent items. We already have pruned all non-frequent items for this F list. And now maybe we should at least count them. So F is present in 4 transactions, if I'm correct. C is present in 4 transactions. F is present in 4 transactions. A is present in 3 transactions. B is present in 3 transactions. M is present in 3 transactions. And P is also. And that's why we will get to this F list down here. Because we are frequently descending this list. Also a valid F list would be, of course, C, F, A, B, M, P. Or C, F, B, A, M, P. There can be multiple valid F lists for a data set. However, you have to decide for one of these F lists, for the whole algorithm. You can change your mind once you have selected one F list. So for us, let's go with this F list, which is one of many valid F lists. This F list is then used to sort the items within each transaction according to this F list. So if F is present in the transaction, it will get named first in our dataset. And then C, then A, then B, then M, then P. Of course, in the first transactions, for example, we do not have B present. So B isn't part of the ordered list because B isn't part of the original transaction. Is that obvious? Any questions on that? I see some confused. Because we only want to find frequent item sets, and based on the a priori principle, we already know that if a subset isn't frequent, the superset can be frequent as well. Basically, since the first step is the same with a priori, we try to save performance in the later steps. So counting two item sets, counting three item sets, and so on. And we do not have to count two item sets that can't be frequent because we do not have a frequent subset, or one subset isn't frequent within that. So we skip that and we can throw it away because it's not relevant for us anymore because we already know it can be part of another frequent item set. And that's necessary to keep the resulting FP tree, we will talk about that in a minute, as small as possible, because the bigger the tree, the more expensive the algorithm gets, of course. So we prune all non-frequent item sets. For example, in this case, we prune the D. D is only part of one. One transaction, so it's non-frequent, and it's pruned from that ordered transaction as well, and from the F list. And we end up with these sorted transactions, sorted and pruned transactions. This right column with the sorted transactions, sorted according to F list transactions, now can be used to create the tree we see down here. Each tree has, of course, a root node. And now we add transaction after transaction. So we start with transaction 100. Transaction 100 contains an F. It contains a C. Now, maybe I should save some space in here. It contains an A. It contains an M. And it contains a B. So after adding the first transaction, we end up with a tree looking like this. But we not only have the first transaction, we have multiple transactions, of course. So next transaction, F, C, A, B, M. F is already present in our tree, so we simply increase the count of F. Then C is also present, we increase the count. A is also present, we increase the count. B is not present as a child of A. Therefore, we have to create a new child node, B, with a count of 1. And then M is not present as a child of B, and therefore we create a child node M. The same is true for the third transaction where we have F and we have B. For the third transaction where we are at the root node and do not have an F, therefore we have to create a new subnode for the root. And so on. The last step I will not do on the blackboard because we end up with this tree. Yeah.
It's important the order, for example, in the second, the M
Genau. Yeah, not genau. Exactly. In English. That's why we have to order according to FAF list before drawing that tree. Because the order is relevant. We want to know, within this tree, we know that if we look at this P node, for example, we know that there are two P's within our data set that are always occurring with M, A, C, and F. But there's also one P that only occurs with a B and an A. This is just another representation of the dataset itself. But you will see that this tree enables us to count frequent item sets really fast. And that's part of the next slides, but for now we have to understand how this tree is created. And due to that order, we ensure that only we have two different nodes M in this case. But these two nodes have different meanings because this M, or these two M's, this M occurring two times, is part of a transaction containing A, C, and F, at least them. While this M also for sure contains a B, or is part of a transaction containing a B. That's why you have to order first, and we have to stick with that order. If we select another order, we will end up with another tree, of course. The tree will also be different. I've seen you. One second. We will end up with another tree, but as long as we are consistent with our selected F list, we will get a valid result at the end of our F list. Yeah. So this M and B down here, basically that's happening. So we have the first transaction, okay? And maybe I shouldn't draw it in this fashion in here. So we have the first transaction, FC A. P. So this is just the first transaction added to the tree. And now we add a second transaction. And we simply traverse down the tree. For the first item within the sorted items, so that, we take a look at the child nodes of the root node, the first layer of our tree. Is there an F present? Yes, there is an F present. Maybe I should stand in here because then you see it in a minute. For the second item within our list, which is a C, we take a look at a child of the F we just filled. So C. The third is A, is part of that. And now we get to the fourth item, B. We take a look at all child nodes of A. There's an M. That's not a B. And there are no other child nodes. And since we do not have a B being a child node of our path we are right now on, we have to create a new node. Of course, you can also draw that to the left, that node. Typically, at least, since it's a algorithm done by a Western person, a person of the Western world, typically we go to the right because we read from left to right, at least in the Western world. So which is what we normally do, but there wouldn't be a problem with the algorithm if you draw it to the left. That's not the point. Is that your question answered? How to create it? Okay. And of course, then we do the same thing for the M. We take a look at the child nodes. There are no child nodes, so we create a new node for that. And we end up with M. This is the result of a second transaction, adding the second transaction. Any other questions regarding building an initial FP3? Yeah, wrong direction. During, yeah. We can create another F list, and therefore we would sort the frequent, we would have another sorted list in here. Yeah, we just have to create a valid F list. Whichever you choose is your thing to decide on. FP growth is an algorithm that might become part of the exam. So there has been a part where you have to perform FP growth freely by hand in the exam, and there always have been questions regarding substeps of FP growth in the exam. Of course, if I ask you to perform FP growth in the exam freely, so every step hand by hand, I would more than likely choose an example where each count of the frequent one item sets is different. Because then we have a unique and only one correct solution. But in the real world, you do not have one correct solution, you have multiple correct solutions. At least for the steps in between. Regardless of the F list you choose, you will end up with the same frequent item sets at the end. But the way is different to where. And this is just the F list we have chosen, but you can choose another F list. Therefore, you sort, you end up with a different ordered frequent item set list, and therefore you end up with a different FP3. Simple as that. Question answered? Okay. Are there any more questions? This first step is important to be able to understand the next steps in here. Okay. Maybe we skip that part and get back to that later on, because that's an optimization. Let's say we are here. We have the initial FP3. This is the same FP3 we have just created from the original database. Now we have the frequent one item sets because we counted them to create the initial FP3, and we have the FP3. But our goal is to end up with every frequent item set of the data set. So question is, how can we use this FP3 to end up with all frequent item sets, basically? And therefore, we have to talk about a different thing we didn't talk about yet. Because in the algorithm itself of FP growth, we not only create an FP3, but we also create a so-called header table. A header table is basically a list of all contained one item sets, their counts, and in the algorithm we also have links from this F list to the nodes containing the item. So the item F would also have a link to this specific node. The Item B, let's go with B, has a count of 3 and has nodes to this node, has links to this node, and to this node, because all of these nodes are concerning B. So we find these nodes easily. And this can then be used to create the so-called conditional pattern basis. For each item, so item F in this case, we take a look at the linked nodes. In this case, we have just this one linked node because we only have one node concerning F. And we take a look at the paths above. In this case, above F, there's no other nodes. So there is no conditional pattern base. For C, we take a look at both linked nodes, these two, and take a look at the paths above. For this node, there's one node above till we get to the root node. So the F is above. For this node, there's nothing above, so we can ignore it. But this node, we have a node above, and we have a count of this node of occurring 3 times. So we know that C in this node is occurring 3 times, 4 times total, but in this combination, it's only occurring 3 times. And therefore, we know that C is occurring 3 times together with F, because that C is above. Why 3 times? Because we know C is only present 3 times. So we have to transport that 3 to the node above. And we therefore end up with a conditional pattern base for C of F times 3. Because 3 times C occurs with F. Any questions regarding that? Okay. Then we can do the same thing for A. A has a node in here, and that's the only node. Let's take a look at the path above. The path above is C and F. A is occurring 3 times, so it's occurring 3 times with the F and C combination. So we end up with the conditional pattern base being FC times 3. Let's do it for B, and then we stop. B has connected nodes here, here, and here. So we take a look at this node. This node has 3 predecessors, F, C, and A. And since B is only present once in this node, we have the conditional pattern base, or the conditional pattern FCA1. This is the first part here. However, this time, the other nodes also have paths before them. This path only has an F before them. So we end up with F times 1. And for this path, we end up with C times 1. Because the path before this node is C, and B is occurring once, so we know that this B is occurring once with a C. And this is how we can create all conditional pattern bases for our data set. We go through that step by step by step by step by step, basically. Are there any questions regarding this step? Yeah. Okay. This is a common misconception. You say for F, which is occurring 4 times, we end up with F only 3 times. I guess that's your question, if I understood that correctly. But for this node, we do not end up with any conditional pattern base, because F, or this node, doesn't have any predecessors. Therefore, there's no conditional pattern for that. This F3 is not this node. It's based on this node. With this node, we know that C occurs 3 times in this node. And now, starting at this node, we check for these 3 C's how often they are occurring with their predecessors. And each of these 3 C's is partnered with 1 F each. Since there are only 3 C's, we can only end up with 3 F's being partners of that C. So we can't get above the count of our single node, because every item can only have 1 partner. And that's why we get to F3 in here for the C node. Of course, there are 4 F's in total in here, but one of them isn't partnered with a C. That's what we can see within that tree. Question answered? I guess 2 rows in front, there was a question, if I remember correctly. Is that question still present? Okay. Are there any questions? Okay. Now we are still not at every frequent item set, of course. But with this conditional pattern base, we would be able to see some other frequent item sets. Those slides are basically what I've explained. I've forgotten that I created some specific slides for that, which is basically what I've just explained with the pointer. You can repeat that in here. Let's take a look at B, to make sure that you understood that. So we have 3 nodes regarding B, and we take a look at the prepaths, and then we end up with FCA 1 time for this path, F 1 time for this path, and C 1 time for this path, which is basically what I've just explained step by step on the previous steps. But the algorithm is not stopped here, of course. For each combination of pattern bases, so not of patterns, conditional patterns, so our conditional pattern base, which is the combination of all conditional patterns for a specific item, we can now again create an FP tree, a conditional FP tree. This is something we do in here for the conditional pattern base of M, which contains 2 different item combinations. So in the original FP tree, we have FCA, FCAB. This can then be used to create M's conditional FP tree. And the process of creating that tree is basically the same as the process creating the initial FP tree. We start with an empty root node, and we now take a look at the first conditional pattern. In this case, the first conditional pattern is FCA. So since it is ordered according to the F list, we create an F as part of that pattern FCA. This time, however, we do not increase the count just by 1, as with original FP3, but we increase the count by s by the same amount the pattern contains. So in this case, FCA is occurring 2 times, so therefore we can increase the count of this node in the FP3 by 2 and get to 2. Then we have C, the same thing is true for this one, and then we have A, the same thing is true for this one. This is just the first conditional pattern, FCA times 2. This is finished right now. Now we have to worry about FCAB1, and this is the same process. F is already present, we increase the count. C is already present, we increase the count. A is already present, we increase the count. B is not present, so we create a new node and increase the count by 1. And that's the conditional pattern tree, basically, of M. So we know for this tree that everything in here always occurs only in combination with an M. That's the condition of the conditional pattern tree. And the same thing can also be done, of course, for every different conditional pattern base we have in here. And once we have that conditional FP tree, we can do the same thing we have done for this original FP3 again and find out all conditional patterns within that FP3. Let's do that. So this is our M's conditional FP3, and we now want to talk about conditional patterns. For F, F is always occurring in combination with M in this case. Do we have a conditional pattern base for this node? Yes or no? Question to you. What's the conditional pattern base of F for this tree? Does F have any predecessors? No, therefore the conditional pattern base is empty. Then we have M combined with C. What's the conditional pattern base for C? Times? Three, yeah. So conditional pattern base of M and C is F3. Then we have MA, conditional pattern base of A. FC times 3. And B, conditional pattern base of B. Times 1, yeah. Okay, basically we do the same thing for every tree. And then we can go one step further and create the conditional pattern trees, frequent pattern trees, of every of these pattern bases. And that's for AM, so basically this one, the FC times 3, we end up with a tree like this. For CM, we end up with a tree like this. For CM, for MC, of course, creating an FP tree can be done, a conditional FP tree, but it only contains one node, so there wouldn't be any sense behind that. And once we have done that, we can potentially create new conditional patterns, create new trees, and so on. So based on this tree, conditional FP tree, we end up with the conditional pattern base for AMC of F times 3. And with that tree, we can create this tree down here, and so on. And at some point, we do not, we aren't able to create more FP trees. That's the end of the algorithm, because now we have created every possible combination of an FP tree. And having that, we can actually find all frequent patterns related to M. How can we do that? Okay, how we end up with M is pretty obvious because we already did that in the first step. We already did determine that M is frequent in the first step. How we end up with FM is more complicated. But let's look at our FP tree in here. We see that M's conditional tree, so if we have an M, we also have F three times. And therefore, we know that Fm is occurring three times. And three is the min support we have to satisfy. Therefore, Fm is also frequent. The same is true for C. C is occurring three times in M's conditional pattern tree. Therefore, Cm is also frequent. The same is true for A. A is occurring three times in M's tree, so Am is also frequent. Are there any other items with a count higher than three in our header table? This header table is not printed in here, but of course there can be header table being drawn for that tree, and only items having a count, a frequency higher than three, or higher and or equal than three, are relevant for us. No, B is only part of a conditional FP tree once. Okay, now we are finished with this conditional FP tree. We have to take a look at the next FP tree. So the next FP tree can, for example, be CM. In CM's conditional FP tree, we have one entry within the header table. That entry is F, and that entry is present three times within that tree. So we know that CMF is occurring three times, satisfying our min support, and therefore we can add it to our frequent patterns. And we can do that for every header table of our entry, of our recursion. To end up with every frequent pattern related to M. Basically, you have to either count how often every item is occurring within these FP trees, or you have a header table, which is how the algorithm does that, and it's easier to do. Within the exercise, we have a task where we do every step of an FP growth algorithm on a smaller database, admittedly, but we do every step of a fpgrowth algorithm by hand. So you will have some repetition on that within the exercise, which is important, I guess, to understand the nitty-gritty of that algorithm after all. However, are there any questions regarding how to use fpgrowth to end up with frequent patterns right now? Can you? Why it was free? So I'm not sure whether I understood it correctly, but I try to rephrase it. So is your question how we end up with a frequent pattern FCM using this conditional FP3? Is that your question? Yes. Okay. So you understood how we end up with the conditional FP3 like here for the combination of CM? Or is that already something you didn't understand? Okay. Then let's talk about that first. You understood how we end up with this table. Okay, perfect. Then let's take a look at this second row in here. We have CM or MC. Order is not relevant in this case. It's a set, after all. A set doesn't have an intrinsic order. But we have M and C. And it has the conditional pattern base of F3. If you do the same process we used to end up with this table, with this FP3, for this conditional pattern base, we end up with this tree, because we have to add one conditional pattern into our tree, and we end up with this conditional FP3. Based on the condition that we have a C and an M present in the transaction. Okay, now we are at this tree. So we are at this tree, and we know that this tree is based on the assumption that a C and an M is present in our transaction. We can draw a header table for this. The header table for this is more or less, so header table again is this middle part. We have an item F based on the assumption that C and M are also present. This has a frequency of 3 and has linked nodes till here. I use that to show you how I, what I was telling you or trying to tell you back when I said nodes are linked. However, the important part is this for finding frequent patterns. Because we have to take a look at every entry within our header table that has a frequency higher than our min support. Or higher or equal min support. 3 is equal 3, and therefore higher or equal than our min support. So we know that this entry has to become a frequent pattern. And this is FCM, just in an order, other order, but as we are back at sets, the order isn't relevant, and we end up with a frequent item set C, N, and F, or F, C, M, or however you want to order them. And that's something you do basically each step of a process. Yeah?
Sorry, again?
The condition starting tree for AM.
For AM?
And MA.
MA, yeah.
This is
same, right? Yeah. Yeah, of course. But you will only end up creating one of them because of the order of the if list. In the process, you wouldn't create both of them because there's a certain order to the f list, therefore there's a certain order within the fp tree, and therefore you only end up with one of them. Any other questions? Okay, if there are other questions, I guess we can solve them during the exercise. That's what we have for exercise for. Okay. Basically, I have one question to you. How often do you think do we touch the original database during the FP growth algorithm? How often do we need to access the database? Because a priori, we have to access the database for each iteration. So k times to find k item sets. How often do we have to touch the original database within FP growth? That's something you should be able to answer. Yeah. Once? No. But close. Sorry?
Twice?
Yeah. We touch it twice. We touch it once to create the one item sets. And then a second time to create our order transaction and create our FP tree. But after we created the initial FP tree, we touch it never again, which is good for performance, also for the database, because we do not have to revisit every tuple every time. But it's also good for the performance to have a more condensed structure. This structure is containing 5 transactions, and it already gives us the information whether P occurs with C, B, P, or not. Okay. Basically, this process has the big advantage that we will find every frequent pattern. There's no way we miss one of them if we follow the process. And we do not touch one of them twice because of these frequent pattern bases. There's no chance we create the frequent pattern base of M within M. And a big advantage is also that these subpaths, basically, once we are here, so we have an initial FP tree. And now we are at our conditional pattern basis. C, A, M, P, I miss P, B in there. These processes of finding the frequent item sets with this conditional pattern base, with this conditional pattern base, with this conditional pattern base, and so on, are not dependent on each other. Therefore, if we want to further increase the speed of FP growth, we can pack this into a thread, we can pack this into a thread, we can pack this into a thread, this and this, and just rejoin after all, because we end up with different frequent patterns for every of these subpaths. And the same is true for of course, for every subprocess in here, all of these are not dependent on each other, if you have done the previous steps, which is also good to increase speed of our algorithm, of course. And therefore, fpGrowth is more complicated. I guess everybody understands now why I said that than a priori. A priori is pretty simple. fpGrowth is more complicated than a priori, but fpGrowth is faster than a priori. In most cases, there's a small edge case. If a database is small enough, then it might happen that a priori is faster than fpGrowth, because fpGrowth comes with a little bit of setup, and therefore there might be a small part where we have problems. One special case I didn't mention, because you can handle this special case with a traditional algorithm, but if you have a prefix path of only one path, so not like our original tree, where we have multiple paths, but you have only one prefix path, you can skip that part, merge it into one node. In this case, this whole prefix path is merged into the node R1, and can even further increase the speed of fpGrowth. However, that's not exactly necessary to do. You can still do it with a traditional process, but you throw away some speed up. The big advantage is, of course, you still end up with the same result, and you have a more compact tree. Basically, that's a formalization of the fpGrowth algorithm. We try to grow fp patterns step by step, iteration by iteration of our recursion. And we end up with an empty fp tree in some step of the process, and we can end the process or the path at that step. And the whole process ends, of course, if no steps are left open. Basically, of course, fpGrowth has some problems for itself. An fp tree, for a small example like this, is of course also pretty small. But for a bigger database, this fp tree, a bigger database with a lot of different items, let's think again about something like Amazon. Amazon might have millions of different items you can buy. And there are also different combinations of these items. And each possible combination of an item, of course, ends up with a different path within the tree. And therefore, you will end up with a pretty big tree with larger databases. And it might happen that there's a point where an fp tree doesn't fit into our memory, which, of course, is not easy to solve. However, it can be solved. For example, you can partition the database into a set of different databases. Pretty much, there are two different options. We can have a parallel projection, where we project the database in parallel for every different frequent one item set, or item set, whatever you want, or item, which is pretty costly for space. Or we can do partitions and do the same for every partition, which saves a lot of space. However, of course, these optimizations are more or less to know that they are there. I wouldn't ask you to explain them in detail in the exam. So do not worry. If I get through something in less detail, you are not expected to explain it in detail in the exam, because I expect some questions on that as well. It would take too much time to explain it in detail in here. I also skip these things because I want to go on, which is basically the explanation in detail in here, but we are not within the time to use that. So it's not part of the exam to explain it in detail again. The divide and conquer approach I already explained in this graphic. So we can skip around that as well and can get to further methods of finding frequent patterns. I do not expect there are any more FP growth questions right now, since I already asked that, but are there any? Okay. Of course, there are other frequent pattern mining algorithms out there to mention. I would argue that a priori and FP growth are the most important and most libraries you will find in the wild will also implement both of them or one of them, and therefore they are the most usable as well. However, there are some other methods that I just want to mention. I will also not get into detail on them, but honorable mentions, I would say. One of them is Eclat. Eclat is something that is based on a data format that is more and more often used in database engineering. Traditionally, you would, of course, save a relational database tuple by tuple. So X, Y, Z, you have columns, and you have our tuples. And you would store each tuple together. These days, you more and more often have a so-called column store, where you do not save tuples, tuple by tuple, but column by column. And this, of course, can be then used to mine frequent patterns more efficiently on these vertical data formats. Vertical data formats is, of course, more general than a column store, but basically it's the same idea. It has the advantage that we only have to take note of different items within each transaction. A second honorable mention, and I will speed up it, will speed up this part again, just honorable mentions, nothing more, is a specific algorithm to find closed item sets. You might remember the terminology we had beforehand. We had max item sets, we had closed item sets, we had frequent item sets, and things like that. Closed set, I'm not sure about the pronunciation of that specific method, but this method is basically created to mine closed item sets. Closed item sets are item sets where no superset has the same count of same support count as this item set itself. Remember that. This method is also based on an F-list, which is basically the same as with fpgrowth. And we can now search or divide our search space by taking a look only at specific subsets because we are a closed item set. Basically, we find a closed item set recursively where we take a look at every transaction and check whether every transaction has having a D has also a CFA, and if that is true, CFAD is also a closed item set. Basically, that's how it works. Yeah, there's a more detailed explanation. I will, get through that because time. So we mind closed item, we mind frequent item sets, a priori and fpgrowth, and also Eclat, finding frequent item sets. We have closed set for mining closed item sets. And of course, there's also a possibility to specifically mine max item sets, which is, for example, max miner, which is tried used to find potential max item sets and then to check for whether they are really max item sets or not. If you're interested, I always link the literature where it was released. However, again, details are not relevant for the exam, the same grain of detail as I use in this lecture is relevant. Mining max item sets has a pretty big advantage, of course. If you found all max item sets, you also found every frequent item set, basically, because you can traverse back down from these max item sets. However, these things are not more efficient than fpgrowth, so no point in doing this way if you want to do that. Now we get to a new chapter, and that's something I want at least to take some time for that, because we have frequent item sets right now. We have one item sets, two item sets, three item sets, four item sets, and so on. However, often you want to have association rules. Association rules are rules like, if I buy A, I'm also likely to buy B. We already talked about that during the first slides of this lecture. But of course, we have to talk about how to generate them efficiently. Basically, we are using confidence. That's also something we already talked about. We do not need only a minimum support to generate an association rule from a frequent item set, but we also need a minimum confidence level to ensure we have strong association rules. If we only take a look at frequent item sets within to generate association rules and skip all non-frequent item sets, which is, makes sense somehow, then we, of course, have already satisfied the min support. And then we can just, for each frequent item set, generate non-empty subsets, so we at least need a frequent two-item set to make a reasonable association rule, and just create variations of that. So let's say we have the frequent item set A, B, C, and D. Then we can split that up into A and B, C, D. We can split that up into A and B, C, D, and so on. We can create multiple combinations. Every combination is possible, and we simply compute the confidence. The confidence can be computed by dividing the support of a combination of both rules. So basically the support of, if we have this rule, we would take the support of this total item set and divide it through the support of the left part of the rule, the determinant. Sorry. if we have the min confidence being satisfied, we can output it, we end up with a good association rule. It's not that hard to do that, but of course we have to talk about that. However, now we have item sets and we have association rules. How do we determine whether a rule is interesting or not? And I guess we have 3 minutes left. Let's save that for next week. I can't finish that within that time. Don't worry about these big tables, of course. Just again, an outlook, not something you have to know by heart. We will not even talk about each formula in here, but some formulas are very important, so we will talk about them next week. Are there any questions regarding the previous slides? Last chance to ask them. Again, we will have an a priori exercise. We will have an FP growth exercise. One thing that I want to mention is exam registration is right now. So if you want to take part in the exam, you have to register on Campo right now. Please make sure you do, because we can change anything on that if you missed the registration period later on. Okay, then we will see us next week at the same time, at the same place. Have a nice week.